Welcome. Today is Wednesday, September 18th, 2019, and I am your host, Susan Mulder. You know, one of the things I love about doing PoetKind is the fact that I get to talk with some incredible creatives. And today's guest is no exception. It was such an honor to be introduced to Ayaz Pirani, and I am thrilled that I get to introduce him to you. Ayaz is a poet and has just released his second book, Kabir's Jacket Has a Thousand Pockets, and I have to say I really loved this book. Ayaz, welcome. I'm so happy to have you here on PoetKind.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm an admirer.
Thank you. You're very kind. I found out about you through a mutual friend, and she told me about your book. Now, I want to say it right. Kabir's Jacket Has a Thousand Pockets.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah,
and that, Kabir's Jacket.
Yeah, and that is your second book. Mm-hmm. But I was so excited to read through your work that I couldn't wait to talk to you. So it's a delight to sit down. For my listeners, I get to be face-to-face, but everybody else just has to listen to us chat. But I'd like to start with the basics. Tell me a little bit about yourself, how you came to poetry, where you come from.
Sure. Well, you know, that's a 1,000-year speech, but I could try. You know, the most obvious facts are, you know, that I was born in Tanzania in a little town called Musoma, which is on the edge of Lake Victoria.
Okay.
And of course, when I was born, those countries were colonies of European powers. In the case of Kenya, Tanzania, Zimbabwe, Uganda, you know, they had all experienced revolutions and, colonization and independence. And in the 70s, my family decided to, I guess, flee in a way. And we went to England and from there to Canada. And basically, I grew up in Kitchener, Ontario.
Okay.
Kitchener-Waterloo, Ontario. Okay. And basically, I'm a Canadian. I spent most of my childhood and youth there. I started university in Toronto. And since then, I've been living in the United States. I've lived in Texas, where I taught school. I'm a teacher. Okay. I taught school, and I've lived in California here for about 15 years in Monterey.
In Monterey, you live in a very beautiful country. Yeah.
It's, in fact, so beautiful that it's hardly can enter my poetry. You know, it's one of those things that I just can't hardly bring myself to write about just yet.
Sure. That makes sense.
Yeah. I guess I've been writing most of my life, and I always thought of myself perhaps as being a poet or wanting to be a writer since I was a kid. And probably that has to do with my ancestry and my culture. So I come from a culture that still has a living oral tradition. In the form of ginans, and so that these are songs or recitations of poems, and people memorize them. They're still recited out loud in performances. You sing them in your home, you know. I grew up in that tradition where it seemed very obvious that you could be a poet or you could be a writer of that kind. And then growing up also in Canada, I encountered the British tradition of poetry and the Canadian tradition as well. And so that's how I got to where I am now, I suppose. I'm basically a teacher and a poet.
Yeah, but you just have this global lifeblood in you that's, you bring so much into your writing. I'm glad you touched on was it Ginnon? Is that right?
Ginnons, that's right.
Yeah, because in your epilogue, you mentioned that, you know, you thanked your mother for seeing those, and also your grandmother for reading books.
Yes.
So you could get at them. And I just think that's really, that's a delightful touchstone for knowing, you know, just how important it is in your life.
Yeah. I would agree. If I may emphasize again the fact that there were also, it's also a oral tradition. So even though there were books around, and that was very important to me, I could read those as well as I could read the British poets, you know, the classics, as the white classics. I could read both on paper, but there was one that I could also experience just by listening. And that was my ancestors' tradition. So I feel like it, I don't know, it gives me something at least, you know, to cling to in my own work.
Yeah, well, I think that comes through in your work. And I took a couple notes down here. One of your poems in particular really is multisensory and how it's described. And I want to say it's the birds.
Correct. It comes in parts.
It comes through the pages real quick, but
that's right.
You know, it emphasizes, you know, a line break, and then there's clapping. And to me, that I read that one many times because the visual and the multi-sensory experience of it was really wonderful. And that, you know, that demonstrates the connection you're talking about between the reading and the hearing, which is so different.
Yes, I wouldn't want to put too fine a point on it or make it too political or anything like that, but there certainly is an important difference between the emphasis on the written word in the West and the emphasis on oral speech, I think, in the East. It's very common, for example, in Pakistan and India, in East Africa, when you go to people's homes, for people to just naturally recite a poem, one or two lines, just a couplet even. And then people will, on the spot, tell you whether it's good or not.
Wow.
You know, they'll make a sound like va or some other sound to let you know that that was good. And then it might even go around the room so that by the end of the evening, everyone has offered a couplet or half the room has offered a couplet. Some better than others, some more comical, you know, rather than serious. You know, I think that is something that I'm trying to go for, even though I, of course, I'm working on the written page.
Yeah. Well, what a beautiful situation you just described, and what a there's an intimacy, and I think with the oral tradition, there would, you know, there's such disconnect between the page and the reader, and then an additional disconnect between the writer. Because I might read something entirely different. You know, I bring my complete ethos to it, and I might not interpret it or discover it the same way the writer intended. And so that oral tradition.
Yeah. Now, of course, that disconnect that you're talking about is. Of course, one of the pleasures of reading books where you don't meet the author or know anything about the author, also because it creates, like, you have to do a lot of work yourself, and it creates a kind of special relationship between you and the book, and the book and the author. And of course, in the West, I think we might fetishize that a little bit, and kind of romanticize that disconnect and the pleasure of the disconnect. But in the oral tradition, as you were saying, you're right there. Often the poet is right there, and you actually have to say whether you liked it or not at the moment, you know.
Yeah.
The other thing I would add to that is that in the emphasis on the written word, it also has a lot to do with a bit of selfishness or proprietariness. These are my words, they're on the page. I've copyrighted them. I'm the one who's produced them. It's a bit, I don't know what the word is. On the other hand, in oral traditions, it's quite common and expected that you would recite a line or two from someone else. It's not quite as selfish. It would be impossible not to quote Kabir that evening, or Ghalib, or Hafiz, yeah, or Rumi, or just they're quoting each other. Just as an example, one of the most famous translations of Kabir are the 100 poems of Kabir by Rabindranath Tagore, a kind of turn of the century poet, translated Kabir. As it turns out, I think almost all of those poems, none of those poems are actually Kabir. Mm-hmm. Scholarship has shown that none of them are authentically Kabir. But of course, it doesn't matter. That's part of the oral tradition, is that everyone is reciting other people's works, and it's perfectly reasonable to do that. It's expected to do that. You're honoring them. Yeah. But I think it would be a little strained and difficult to try to do that in Western settings, where you go to a reading and someone comes up on the podium and they read their work. You might read it at home, but it would be both rude and unexpected to borrow. That's not how it is elsewhere.
Yeah.
You're supposed to borrow.
It's a communal experience.
It is.
Opposed to one of self-ownership.
Yes. Now, both are important, of course. I'm not trying to say one is better than the other. Both have been fetishized in their own communities, and both have their problems. But you can clearly see that there are beauties in both.
Yeah.
And I feel like I'm trying to access both of those worlds.
Yeah. Well, I think in some of these writings, I don't know, I was very transported. And because you'd introduced other elements to it, it was a layer of curiosity that I had in your writing that I hadn't experienced maybe in reading somebody else's. Because then I would recognize that you maybe use a different line somewhere else. And I'd be flipping back through trying to find it. Okay, what does he say there? And going back and forth. And I appreciated that. Often the experience of a book is, okay, I've read that. And I've read that. I've taken it in. I've eaten it, digested it. But I don't necessarily relate within it. So it was fun to have a different kind of experience with the book. So,
you know, I'm not sure whether I totally I'm on the same page that I've figured out what you mean by that. But I do think that you know, one of the things that we thought about in editing the book and preparing it was how much explanations I needed to offer for untranslated lines or for references that might be outside of an American audience's, landscape, you know, things, whether they're geographic or the name Nakalunki or, so how much to include in all of that so that people could get as much out of it as possible, but then also feeling that, the reader should do a certain amount of work on their own, you know, and that some of the mystery would be beneficial. Mm-hmm. And in the end, not knowing all of the details might actually be useful for the reader.
I think it enhanced my experience of the book because I was forced to, I had to work for it.
Yeah. And the other thing I thought you might have been suggesting was that you noticed that, it's kind of embarrassing actually, but you might have noticed that, you know, I repeat myself in the book and I borrow my own lines.
That's not
different parts of the book. Well, although that, if I may say, to be totally clear about it, is that, you know, that kind of stuff is, you know, I was asked to remove that kind of stuff. And the idea is that readers of my manuscript often mentioned that you don't often see that in poetry published in North America. And it could be seen as redundant or I don't know what the right word is. I'm so sorry.
Oh, that's okay.
That was very important to me. I was trying to make sort of like a constellation of ideas. And in a lot of ways, I'm really only writing about a dozen poems, but I just keep writing them over and over again. Mm-hmm. And I never come to this feeling that the theme or the idea is finished. I can't think of any topic or any subject that I'm writing about where I say to myself, oh yeah, I did it. You know, that one's over with now. I can move on. It's never that way. I'm always sitting down to write the same poem I already wrote in a lot of ways.
Well, it brings to mind, somebody whose work is translated. Not every translator is going to translate it exactly the same way. Mm. So when you go back to your own work, you're bringing a whole new experience to it. So it's a retranslation, but it becomes its own piece and can stand on its own once you have gone back to it. Am I getting anywhere close to?
Yeah, I think you are. You know, I recently read a short interview with the Canadian poet Billy Ray Belcourt. He won the Griffin Prize last year, I think. And somebody asked him, like, what's so great about writing poems? Why do you write poetry? And he said, well, the good thing is that there's no end to the ways I can say the same thing. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't have to search around for like a new plot if it was a novel, or I don't have to look around for a whole new historical period to write about if it's nonfiction.
Yeah.
I can basically just have one or two things to say, but I can say them forever. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing I love so much about writing poems and the practice of poetry, like having a professional practice of writing where it's something you do every day, is that when it's poetry, you don't have to panic so much. Even though writer's block can be daunting and can feel bad, sooner or later you're going to remind yourself that you don't actually have to invent something new or come up with a new plot. You can pretty much just write about the same thing you wrote about the day before, and it will be different.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and I think as a culture, the Western culture, especially now, novelty is so important. You have to be unique, and you have to do something entirely different. And I think sometimes when you step that far away from the core of what you're trying to say and try to reinvent it so nobody's ever said it this way before, you create an awkward space, and I think it loses some of the authenticity. And that's just my personal perspective, but I love the revisiting. I've been used to that a little bit in my own writing, maybe not necessarily repeating lines, but revisiting the same scene, maybe looking at it sitting in a different seat.
It does prove probably useful and fruitful to be a very inventive and avant-garde and speculative, especially when you have there are sort of underlying political purposes or so for example it's reasonable for post-colonial writers or writers that are talking about queer issues or trans issues to invent new forms for their work, or as they say, to decolonize language in their work, or to be very speculative and almost mad in the way that they concoct like their page. Yeah. And because their purposes are, part of the purpose is to break the canon and to decompose the canon and all of that. And so thankfully they are out there doing that, you know. But I must say, even though I probably do have some of those political purposes, I'm always much more fascinated by looking backward than forward. Mm-hmm. It might just be a peculiar part of my personality, but I just find so much more richness in my ancestors than I do in the future.
I would have to agree with you there, but as far as the political purposes, I think you almost end up in a whole different form of what's trying to be said. And so in order for somebody to, I think you said, explode the canon, that's necessary and good. Mm. It's not always easy for the, I don't want to say consumer, but the reader, the person who's trying to connect with that, but it requires so much more from us. And mm-hmm. I think that's just as important too. So,
yeah, it can seem very abrasive at times and incoherent, you know, mad almost, mm-hmm. you know, and sometimes it requires so much scholarship and work. I'm thinking, for example, of another very fine First Nations Canadian poet, Jordan Abel, whose work at times is like impenetrable for me. But I'm so glad that he's doing that. And of course, the scholarship on his work is very important. And it's probably just because I'm not trying hard enough. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But you know, it takes all kinds, thankfully.
Yeah. Well, and his voice, I'm sure, speaks very deeply to the space it needs to be met.
Yes. Well, he's lauded. He's one of the best. So clearly, yes.
Yeah. So I feel like I need to be taking more notes when I talk to you. It's like, okay, I need to look up this person. So.
Well, I don't mean to name drop. Just to make it.
Oh no, it's always clear. Wonderful to hear the name of somebody else that, you know, I can explore, or my listeners can explore, and we might not have ever heard those names before. So. Well, let me ask you this, because we've talked about your work and we've talked about others' work. Let's focus specifically on your work. And would you be willing to share a piece or two with us so that
sure.
listeners can hear your words and your own?
Yeah, voice? That's so kind of you. Yeah, I'd love to read something.
Yeah, well, feel free to pick what you'd like and share. Okay. I think there's such a gift. For others to hear a poet recite their work in their own voice, because I think it adds just another layer of, it sounds lighthearted, but joy and understanding to it. So I appreciate your willingness to share.
Well, thank you. Let me read something from Kabir's Jacket Has a Thousand Pockets, if you don't mind. It's the first poem in the second section. It's called Anti-Martyr. So I don't know if I should introduce it in any way. You can probably tell by the title that I'm trying to be contrarian. Mm-hmm. I suspect that all of your listeners, just like me, get fed a particular version of what a Muslim is, or what the Islamic world is like.
Right.
And usually, of course, it's represented as almost entirely Arab, even though most Muslims are not Arabs.
Okay.
And almost always in described as either from the two main spheres, the Persian sphere or the Arabic sphere, even though most Muslims are neither of the two, they're living in the rest of the world.
Oh.
And then, of course, in popular news and in the media, we often see the Muslim as the man in the street or the woman in the street filled with passion, that their voices are shrill and the blood is boiling and they're angry at something and they want to destroy something. And of course, most Muslims aren't like that at all. They're just regular people.
Right.
So I suppose that's the origin of this poem, which is anti-martyr.
Okay. Whenever you're ready.
Okay. I don't have to love my lashes to be a prophet among my people. You'll never see me on fire or at the moment of impact. My glories aren't blazes. I won't drink blood or eat brain. My people don't ask for my head to be put in the lion's mouth. They don't mind if I lie in gutters, since dust ignores me. None of them want to see me in pieces or remembered as a wisp of smoke. I'm not to be kept in dungeons or away from my favorite food. I'm not the kind of prophet you worship or stone. Don't worry about the jokes I tell. I'm just trying to keep the birds happy.
I do love hearing someone read work, and for me, it creates this experience where all my emotions, and I even get physically involved. I mean, I just was having all these feelings listening to you, and what a gift! Thank you. I mean, I'm speaking of redundant. I keep thanking you, but I read it. I read it a few times when I was going through the book, but never quite the same way as you did. And it just changes how I get to enjoy it now, because I will hear your voice in the future.
Mm. Well, it's kind of you to say. I must say that when I read this poem, it's, I guess, like a feat. It's always in my set list. I almost always read it, but
okay.
When I do read it in public, I read it much slower and I have more pauses in the lines. And I try to make it, I guess, as, I don't know how to describe it, but, you know, I like to have pauses so long that you can almost hear people squeak in their chairs at times.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I couldn't bring myself
to. Comfortable with silence.
Right.
Most people are not comfortable with silence. And so the necessity of being quiet and still,
mm-hmm.
people start to fight against that. So
mm-hmm.
probably a great tool when you read.
Mm. I felt awkward about doing it. Now, of course, because people are just listening, so it wouldn't have that same sort of effect. But thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for sharing that. So you're living in Monterey. Do you get out and do readings? Are there places that people can find you if they're out in that neck of the woods? Which they're lucky if they get a chance to hear you.
Yeah, well, there are a few readings in Monterey. Most of the good old bookstores still have readings, like Bookshop Santa Cruz and Old Capital Books in Monterey is a great old bookstore. You could spend all day in there. And they have readings. I think I'm reading there probably in November. I can't remember the exact date or anything like that. It's held by the Monterey Bay Poetry Consortium. It's like a reading series. And next month, actually, I'm reading in Toronto.
Oh, fantastic.
At the Art Bar Poetry Reading Series. Okay. That's on October 15th, if anybody's out in TO.
Yeah, get out there. Mm. Well, I'm going to tell everybody one more time about your book. It's Kabir's Jacket Has a Thousand Pockets, and it is by Mawenzi House. Is that correct?
That's right. They're a Toronto publisher. They sort of are recognized as a publisher of writers of color.
Okay. Yeah. We'll give them a little shout out. And then for those of my listeners out there who aren't familiar with you, share where we can find you online so they can learn more about your work and that sort of thing.
Well, I have to say, if you don't mind my saying, after the Christchurch shooting, I had to get off of Facebook. I can't connect with everyone that way, but I am on Instagram, even though I know it's owned by Facebook, but there's very little politics on Instagram.
Yeah.
I haven't encountered much hate at all. That's all just photos of cats, you know, and stuff, stuff like that. Anyways, I'm on Instagram by my own name, Ayaz Kalani. And I have a website, but it sort of just floats out in space and I have no idea what happened. You know, it's just out there. And my books are available at all good bookstores.
Yeah.
And it would be, sorry.
You gonna tell us a little about your other book?
Oh yeah. I don't know if you've seen it.
I have not seen it. Happy You Are Here.
Yeah, it's called Happy You Are Here. It's published by The Word Works. It came out in 2016.
Okay.
And, I don't know what to say about it now. All I've been thinking about is Kabir's jacket for a year or two.
Right.
But, yeah.
All right. Well, Happy You Are Here by Ayaz Kalani. And that's going to go on my want to read list, which is quite monumental.
Sure.
So,
of course.
Or the stacks on the floor that I get to see. So, but, thank you very much for spending a few moments chatting with me and
thanks for having me.
Maybe to get to know you. It has been a real pleasure.
Well, hello to all your listeners. I'm a listener too. Thanks for inviting me. Thank you to Licia Morelli for connecting us.
Yes.
And thanks for letting me read a poem.
Yeah, thank you. Well, and I hope you'll come back and do it again sometime.
Sure. Like that. Great. Thank you.
I hope you'll take a few moments to find Ayaz on social media. And again, that is Ayaz Pirani, P-I-R-A-N-I. And head over to his website, ayazpirani.com, to find out where he'll be performing next and to learn more about him and his writing. I also want to encourage you to find his book, Kabir's Jacket Has a Thousand Pockets, out now on Amazon and other book retailers. And remember, you can request your favorite titles at most small booksellers if it's not already on their shelves. So add this one to your bookshelf today. That's it for this week on Poetkind. Thank you for spending some time with us today, and what a gift it is to sit with new people, to learn at the feet of someone whose words and work bring the world to us in a different way. And one last thank you to Ayaz. It was a joy to speak with you today. Please look for Poetkind on Instagram and Twitter at Poetkind Podcast, and make sure you say hi. You can always reach out to us via email at poetkindpodcast@gmail.com as well. Until next time, create. Be. Live into what you are meant to do, and remember, we're always better together. Let's compare notes, not ourselves.